Hello, and welcome to GFW Radio. This is the podcast for April 16th, 2006.
Oh, wow.
It's the 15th.
I'll never
today.
Get it right,
it's the 15th,
ever.
2006.
I mean, like, you know, you might be like, okay, 2007, whatever, but 2006.
So I'm sorry.
How did you miss it by 2 years?
I don't know. It's 2008. I'm sorry.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I am. I'm really sorry.
Is it 2006 in your head?
I'm both. It is.
Are you living in the past?
Yeah, it was a better year. This is Jeff Green, and I'm here with the usual cast, along with a special guest who I will introduce first. We have Elliot Chin, who is now director of marketing over at Sega. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Also, a former CGW staff person from 95
to 98. Got my proud start in the gaming industry as an intern first and then assistant editor at Computer Gaming World.
Mm-hmm.
Working for Johnny Wilson.
The legendary Johnny Wilson.
The legendary, yes.
Then you went on to GameSpot after that.
Went to GameSpot, yes. Built it up from a little hovel into the greatness that it is now. And then after that, just retired because I'd done all there was to do.
Well, you went to Blizzard.
Oh, yeah. I did go to Blizzard, too.
Yeah.
After I was a teacher for 3 years.
So you've been all over. And in all those different job changes, I have never left.
That's true.
So the GFW crew is as follows.
Ryan Scott.
Sean Elliott.
And Sean Malloy.
Hi.
Hello.
Desmond, can you tell us where you're at?
Desmond? Are we going to do what? Is that...
Never mind.
Lost.
Are you his what? Constant or
long
something?
Belated joke? You and your well, just because he doesn't know what time it is and oh. He knows where he's at.
No, I'm back in 2006 now.
You need an anchor of some sort. Maybe Elliot can be your anchor.
Elliot's my anchor.
I think Jeff is Elliot's anchor.
Yeah,
the whole time.
So yeah, when I got my start at CGW in '96, Elliot was kind of. I guess we were like the two associate editors back then. Is that right?
Might have been.
I just sat next to you.
You might have sat. I was still assistant editor, actually.
Were you?
Yeah, because the more senior staff said I had to pay my dues, and I'd have to work there for many years before I get promoted.
I think it's just because you were a minority.
Yeah, that's probably right. They don't promote the non-white staff.
So in the old days, we used to play games all the time at work.
That's all we did.
That's all we
did. We'd squeeze some work into the game playing.
It's really not that way now because we don't do that. Even though Sean Elliott always tries.
I don't believe you. Are you telling me you really work?
Seriously. Do we play games at work?
I think
it's not a whole lot.
The ratio is way off, yeah.
We would sometimes, like Jeff, myself, Dave Salvatore, old tech editor, we would be in the lab playing Quake Deathmatch from probably 10 until 2. Or something,
yeah.
Even more than that. We literally for the whole week.
It was so bad.
4 hours of Quake.
Elliott and I drove in together, and we would go from the car to our cubes where we would just drop off our backpacks and go straight into the lab. Because in those days, we had like a lab with like, you know, whatever, 8 PCs all networked together. We would go straight in there and just play Quake. Like the second we came in. It was like just like we worked at an arcade and just played.
Were you working on a Quake article?
No.
Oh. No. It had nothing to do with anything. Yeah. It was, I don't even know how did we do that. And then you look at the issues we made, and they're like 350 pages.
How many staff members did you have? What percentage were these three
people? Well, there were like, 14 or 15 people on the staff.
No, we didn't have that many people.
Count it, really.
And more than half of those pages were advertisements, too.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
I mean, it was still like a lot of bang for your buck. But
yep. Yeah, that was.
You know, you're making me sad because it's like last week I was able to sneak over to Richard Lee's area, you know, and the My Cheats guys, and we were playing Soul Calibur 2. But yeah, outside of catching you guys playing a little bit of World of Warcraft now and then, I can't get anyone in this building online to play a game.
Yeah. I guess the advantage we had back then was there really were a lot of editors. So you could have like a decent multiplayer match.
Yeah, we would have all 8 stations just filled up with someone playing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really true. In fact, it was almost like an arcade because you'd have dudes waiting to sit down to get in on the LAN match.
Yeah, we had our art guys playing. Remember Joe
Valina?
Valina.
The other thing is there were some classic foils. There were like one or two guys on the staff, and I've mentioned this before, who were complete, total poor sports. So you wanted to play just for the opportunity to make them feel shitty.
Oh, I know who you're talking about.
James. Yeah. That's okay. I wouldn't mention Dave by name.
Yeah, don't. Because
the guy who would throw shit.
Yeah.
Like in righteous anger when he would get fragged.
Yeah.
Bullshit! Every time. He never was fragged, honestly, once.
Never.
Ever.
Always cheap. Yeah.
You were always either sniping or camping.
Yep, exactly.
Never. Camping. You never got him. That was honestly.
Yeah. Always an excuse.
Yeah, if I camped, I could win too. Sorry, I'm yelling.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. We don't want to make this be a total old man nostalgia fest while the three guys here are going, yeah, that's great, Grandpa. Yeah. Huh? Anyway, back on Earth.
Yeah. But it's a fun time, though.
It was a good time.
It was great to work on the magazine.
I really don't. Yeah. I honestly don't remember now how we got all those pages done.
Well, you know what? Well, you and I probably were responsible for at least like 50, 60% of it. We would write a lot of shit and then hope no one saw it and just put it in the magazine.
We did write a lot in those days. It really was. It was very, very, very different in those days.
What was that red caption that you wrote that we were looking at the other day?
Oh my God!
It was for an Olympics game.
That was
the caption said "Discus amongst yourselves."
Discus amongst yourselves. And then the other one was for a soccer game and it said "Pele with me."
Oh
yeah. Well, that was the time of puns.
Yeah, yeah. I remember.
Every headline was a pun. Every. You know, we didn't have, like, that was a big deal when CGW changed from doing that. Like, the game, like, the reviews, in the review section, every headline was a pun.
It had
it was
some
almost
clever,
mandated.
It was mandated. Johnny said you had to have something clever, something fun as your headline.
And it would all be ones that, like, now we would just be, wah, wah. You know? So then when we changed to just have it be, like, whatever, Fallout 2.
Yeah.
Then we got, like, hate mail, because we were, like, bleaching the personality of the
magazine. I hated it. I wasn't on staff at the time, but I saw that.
You hated that we changed away from the puns?
Well, could you have the pun in the subhead?
I think you could, couldn't you?
No.
No?
No, you had
that as well?
Right.
Comedy zone?
Exactly.
Just like right before in the magazine that's never coming out, we had Sean Baby did the story on the least funny Leisure Suit Larry gags, and we had those three renders of characters from Leisure Suit Larry, and the last is from the forthcoming game, and they've decided to... It's a weird hybrid between the stylized cartoonish look of the game, but then also, you know, normal mapped, you know, 3D rendering, and... So the Larry's uncle or whatever this character is the most grotesque, nasty thing ever. But this thing where we continue to refer to him as like a trash bag full of tapioca because he basically, I don't know, that's what he looked like to me. Just like with all the rumples and it's pretty vile. But there was like a running gag with that and it's
going to be lost to time now.
Well, it'll show up online, won't it?
I don't know. That was very specifically tied to the layout.
It's a very print joke.
Maybe so.
But we can get some mileage out of that render, though. That thing's not going away in the future.
Yeah.
It's a magnificent render.
So right before we came downstairs, we just happened to look at this one. Oh, I had those big, these big, gigantic, beautiful poster size.
Old covers?
Old covers of CGW. And I found one that just happened to be maybe the most controversial one of your era. Maybe this can just be the last nostalgia thing before we move on, which was the StarCraft 1 cover.
That's right.
And actually, why don't you say what the big deal was, the big controversy?
So I had gone down to see the game and ride with the cover story. And when it came time to – it was an ordeal in itself to actually even get agreement from the senior staff to actually put StarCraft on the cover. Right.
Because at that time –
It wasn't real-time strategy games weren't really considered. You know, some people thought maybe they were a fad, or they weren't here to last. They weren't true strategy games because back in the day we'd play some Warcraft 2, and you know sometimes we'd have editors making fun of us for playing a game that they thought was all click-based and not strategy-based. So anyway, finally we did get StarCraft on the cover, and it came time to write the headline for the cover, and I wanted to call it Best Strategy Game Ever. I just unequivocally, StarCraft is awesome. This game is great. It's going to be great. I just want to call it the best strategy game ever.
Yeah, you were down there and you came back utterly gung-ho for that game. You were just like, you guys aren't going to believe how fucking awesome this thing is. So,
I think, you know, Johnny and a couple other people on staff said, no way, there's no way. And they're like, how can this game be better than Civilization or Mule or all these other games? And I'm like, I think it's the best strategy game ever, and it's going to be the best strategy game ever. Like, no, it can't. And then so then they qualified and said, okay, best real-time strategy game ever.
And then, which was kind of a joke at the time because there hadn't been many yet.
There was like Dune, you know, Warcraft 2 and, you know, Command & Conquer, and then now there's going to be StarCraft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but and then I thought, okay, that'd be fine. But then, for some reason, then they quibbled over the ever, you know, at the end of the sentence, best real-time strategy game ever. And they thought, well, no, it can't be. You know, like, let's give it some time. Maybe after a while, people will start thinking this is a really great strategy game. So we'll just say yet. You know, because remember, there hadn't been many real-time strategy games, yeah. You know, yet. So, you know, at the end of the day, we're like, okay, fine. You know, our victory wasn't getting the game on the cover itself. And
right.
That, and so now that issue, you know, best real-time strategy game yet. And I think if you reflect on it now, I bet you won't get many arguments from people that would proclaim that as, you know,
right.
the strategy game ever.
You probably could have said your original line and it would hold up.
Yeah.
Like, how far along was the game when you saw it that you were, like, able to declare that already?
Oh, I pull stuff out of my ass all the time. But, you know. But on that particular one, you know, which I felt was very true, it was, you know, I'd had the designers walk me through, you know, saw the Protoss and how they play, saw the Zerg and the Creep. Saw the Terrans and, you know, the moving around of the, you know, how they were nomadic. You could move around the buildings and all that. Saw a lot of the interdependencies between the units and you know, the rock, paper, even to call it rock, paper, scissors would be a disservice to the game balance in that game, actually. Just all that was already in there to see and recognize. So, I mean, there was a lot of great thought that went to that game, and it was a really strategic game in addition to being just very fast-paced and very fun. So it's just clear to see early.
Should have arrived at the question mark. Best strategy game ever.
Ever?
No,
yeah, that would have worked.
Yeah.
It was a weird time at the staff because it was very kind of like there were like two schools of thought. There really hasn't been that kind of, I wouldn't call it generational divide. It wasn't by age, but there was definitely kind of like an old school and new school amongst the staff. You know, there was the group that had been with CGW longer who were very much in the old turn-based is where it's at. They weren't, you know, action games were not something you really did on the PC. Flight sims, war games.
Yep.
And, you know, I guess it was around the time you started, around 95, when the shift started happening towards FPSs and stuff.
Yeah, Duke Nukem 3D.
Right.
Come out, you know,
and CGW in those days was slow to kind of adopt that as something worth writing about.
Yes, it was.
Yeah. But.
But, yeah, that was a long time ago. It was fun.
It was a long time ago. Anyway, that was then.
Thank you for reminiscing with me, Elliot Chin.
We could do this all day.
Yeah, we could.
We'll have to have our own podcast.
There we go.
Keep going.
No, no. Well,
it's good. Yeah, yeah.
What more? I'll tell one more.
Okay.
You get your dirtiest.
He's not, he can't stay very long. So
okay. Yeah. That's true. That's right. We got another
hour. Talk about other things after that. Yeah.
Well, I just remember the one day of actually getting, and I guess probably in the whole 10 years I've been here, of actually getting yelled at like being in school or having like a mean boss who busts you. And that was because I was fucking around with you when we were on deadline. Like, you and I both had articles to write, and we were late.
Yeah, as usual.
As usual. And some things never change.
Yeah, wait, no.
The only difference then was I was not in charge.
Yeah.
So I actually was held accountable. And you and I were both sitting at our cubes. We were at cubes next to each other, and we were playing Heroes of Might and Magic multiplayer.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a turn-based game, so you would move all your shit and then click end turn, and the other guy would go. So, you know, the other guy would be alt-tabbed out, you know, doing work or pretending to work. And then over the cue ball, we'd go, okay, you know, your turn or whatever. Yeah. We'd have some kind of thing. And then you'd alt-tab back.
Yeah.
And, you know,
was that like a secret code?
Yeah.
Like,
like a bird call. So it was like a contentious, it was just one of those weeks where it was like stressful, or maybe it was just that day where shit had to get done. And yet we were fucking around anyway.
Oh, but hey, we're still doing work. We're doing work half the time, and the other half the time we're doing our turn.
Half the time.
Right, we're
that's
taking
right.
our turn. Yeah.
Yeah, but we couldn't just not play a game because that's all we did. And Ken was making the rounds, you know, kind of like a teacher walking around the classroom, you know, checking up on people. And I like totally, you know, I heard him coming, but I didn't quite alt-tab fast enough. And he leapt on me. It was like out of like a fucking like, you know, I don't know, like old movie with like a British schoolmaster or something. He was just like, you are busted. And he just yelled it and pointed right in my face. I felt so, so bad. And
did you have to have an office talk with him about it?
It was just, no, he was just, he did yell. He was just like, turn that shit off, you know, right now. Do your fucking articles. I mean, he was no, no. He's a great guy, and and we had it coming.
Yeah.
It was like, fuck.
Did you leave it on, though? Did you just minimize it, or did you actually shut it off?
I don't think we would have shut it off.
We probably didn't shut it off.
I'm sure we left it on.
It wouldn't have been in character
just
to shut it off.
Wait until Ken leaves. Yeah. And then I'll tab.
Yeah. Those Quake days that we brought up before, like, I always felt bad. Like, we would be driving home. Some days that's like all we did, and we'd be like, yeah. Oh, man.
I know.
Fuck, I didn't do shit.
6 hours of Quake and then 2 hours of, you know, editing.
Yeah.
Whatever.
You just feel guilty.
Yeah. But it was fun, though.
I didn't earn my money today.
When you were hiring managing editors yourself, was that, like, in the back of your head a criteria? It's like, is this guy going to yell at me? He doesn't seem like the yelling type.
Yeah. No, Ken was great. He really was.
No, he wasn't. And the funny thing about, you know, Ken was also, he was always able to sort of walk that fine line between, you know, understanding the old guard and then understanding the new kids, you know.
That's true. And I should say, you know, about Johnny Wilson, that even though he was, you know, he was the king and you know, very much old school, he, right up till the time he left, was always incredibly open-minded about games. Mm-hmm. Like, he often didn't get enough credit for that.
Yeah.
You know, there were guys on the staff who were actually more conservative than him.
Yeah.
And do you remember, you were on staff when we had the Game of the Year vote for Diablo 1, right?
Yeah, I was there, yeah.
Because at that time, you know, the old and new school, there was such a war between these two things that when the Game of the Year vote came, it was almost like, you know, a presidential election, political contest, you know, factions warring, like, everybody's got to vote for the, like, you know, because this was the year of Quake.
Was it? Quake?
I'm going to blow
this.
Was
the same year as Diablo?
But I just remember we were going around scheming for votes because we didn't want whatever.
Civilization 2 might have come out that year.
It was either Civ 2 or it was Alpha Centauri.
Oh, it could.
Maybe. There was some turn-based, old-school turn-based strategy game that Elliot and I were determined was not going to win. And so we were going around the office like, you got to vote, you know. If you like this or this, just vote for Diablo.
Vote for Diablo.
Yeah, even if it's your second choice, because we don't want this other game to win. Because CGW will look too fucking old if we do that. So don't vote for that. And in the end, when the votes were counted, because we did a secret ballot, and Diablo was the overwhelming winner. Like, we were totally surprised, even though we were lobbying for votes.
Yeah,
the vote was so out was so lopsided that we had no clue. And you know, Elliot and I had written down before, you know, well, we know Johnny's going to vote for Alpha Centauri. We know that TC's going to vote for or whatever game it was.
Yeah.
And it turned out that Johnny had voted for Diablo.
Yeah.
And that totally surprised us, and that was one of the things that made me realize, you know, he was always going to be kind of forward-thinking, no matter whatever reputation he had. So.
Yeah, that's true.
Yep. Those are fun times.
They were.
There's similarities. It sounds also like, I mean, imagine people that were working at Rolling Stone at the time when you know, hip-hop was just starting to blow up. Whether or not the magazine should cover that. And then and to a different extent, even now, there's like this thing that I run into when I talk to a lot of the younger people here, and they're like way into shooters. And it's like, we just have to agree to disagree that like these are meant to be played with the mouse, depending on the one. I mean, I always have to say that. But for the, you know, and then I just like, I'll just watch a video of like Quake 3 tournament play or something. And I look at that and I'm like, how can any gamer look at this and not say, you know what? He's right.
Yeah.
You can't do this with the controller, you know? And it's like, part of it's just experience, you know? I mean, I just feel like, you know, you want to, when you play that kind of game, you're in the competitive mood, you want to be the best that you possibly can. And I always feel like, this is a handicap. This is a crutch, and I can't, and it's like entirely impeding my ability to do what I want, you know? That's another, could be a generational thing.
Yeah.
And it's funny, though. There are going to be kids that grow up now that will never have known a shooter with a mouse. It's just going to be a
gamepad.
Then it will, like,
really
then there will be
started with Halo.
Cyclical thing, and it'll be, like, reintroduced as a gaming device, and it will, like, catch on again, and people will be like, oh, my God, have you tried this new interface?
I actually remember when you taught us, Elliot Cheng was the one who taught us how to circle strafe, because that
how do you
was,
need a lesson in
because
that?
It was new at the time. All we had was the keyboard, remember, in the old days
for Doom. Yeah,
so right. You're using WASD and the arrow keys, right?
Yeah,
But you, like, I mean, that's like, did any, when you went to the arcade and played Battlezone, did someone have to teach you how to do it there?
Well, no.
We had to keep your...
I don't know. I just remember sitting there. It was almost like a like a typing class or something.
Yeah.
Like me, Dave Salvatore, Ken Brown, Johnny Wilson all sitting there. And
yeah.
Elliot Chin's going, no, you got to, like, you know...
Here, hit the arrow key here and then turn the mouse so you
like
keep
this,
your target in view.
Is
and,
this
you
know. Right, Mr. Chin?
Wow.
I can run with the shift button.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, because you used to just fucking kill us.
Yeah, despite what you know, everyone else, you know, Dave and Joe and all those guys would say, yeah, you know, you're not that much better, but yeah. Yeah,
you actually were one of the great trash talkers. You probably weren't kidding, though. Maybe you were serious. I don't know. But you had you were kind of a prick a lot of the time.
Yeah, no.
You were just like, I'll beat you all. Fuck, yeah, you guys all suck. And I would laugh because I knew I sucked. It didn't matter. But guys like Dave would
Dave would get pissed.
So mad.
No, but
at you.
See, I'd say it was straight face. But yeah, no, I totally meant it. But Dave would be like, no, he would be so, his face would be red and, you know.
Yeah. And then you would just destroy.
Yeah.
You
but
would.
Then on the one occasion when maybe they'd win. So we'd play maybe like 10 matches. They'd win 1 out of 10. And then like they would be dancing and hollering and, you know, getting so excited about that one victory. Yeah.
That's bad. That happens too. Like when I play people from our friends list on Steam and stuff, and then, you know, people from the message boards. And if you're playing deathmatch and they'll get a single kill, they'll start going crazy.
Yeah.
Like, I killed you. I killed a magazine editor. we're playing, no, seriously, like we're playing, you know, COD4 or something, team deathmatch or straight free for all. And, you know, for 20 minutes, it's like, okay, I died. Holy shit. Imagine that.
Yeah.
You are superhuman to them.
Yeah.
You know, but now I'm an old man like Jeff, so I can't play these games anymore.
Yeah. I think we figured you are now as old as I was when I started.
That's correct. Yep.
Which is kind of
pathetic. I'm now 35, and that's when Jeff started at CGW.
Still
do it.
I could still play.
Yeah, you probably still got it, you think?
Outside of the... I don't think it's the age at all. I don't feel like any... You know, like I've been playing a lot of COD4 hardcore servers, and not in the least bit threatened by players other than their commitment to it. So the people that are putting in...
Yeah,
that are 4 to 5 hours a day.
Yeah.
And people on that level. And that's just basically a mountain of... I mean, just practice, you know? Like anyone who's going to do something at that level.
Yeah.
It's true. It is.
Like piano or...
Probably like riding a bike.
Yeah.
So do you still get a lot of time to play? I mean, are there games that you feel like you would be awesome at right now?
No. I mean, don't really have that much time to play. I mean, I've been playing, you know, Call of Duty 4, awesome. I actually loved... last game I played that I loved was Portal. I love that. Mm-hmm. You guys have all played that, finished it, right?
It was our game of the year here.
Yeah, the ending was... dude, I just love that ending. Mm-hmm. The end credits.
Jeff, 17 hours.
Yeah. It did. It did. You could look on my Steam account. 17 hours.
Yeah. Nice.
Yep. How do you feel about
good
that?
Good going, Jeff.
Yeah. He's not even surprised.
But no, Company Heroes, I liked. I mean, Jeff knows this. I used to play, I mean, I, you know, love RTS, so played a lot of that. We played, you know, Warcraft 2 at the office. And you remember when Ensemble Studios came by and the first time they showed us Age of Empires was a multiplayer game? We played it in the lab. We played multiplayer and that game was awesome. And, and that was the one actually, like TC and Johnny, they all got excited about that as well.
That's
and
right.
Age of Empires.
That was the first really real-time strategy game that the old school guys got into because it had that same kind of look.
It had, you know, Bruce Shelley, you know, coming in to show us the game. I mean, they got excited about it.
Right.
That probably tipped them over the, you know, over the edge as
until
far as
then,
embracing, you know, RTS.
There definitely, genre. There was one moment where they really did, Elliot and I were playing, I guess it was Warcraft 2 in the lab, and they came over and were basically like pointing and laughing, you know, because we thought we were playing a strategy game and didn't know any better. That was infuriating.
But we did get them to play Age of Empires, though. They actually did,
we did
play that, that was the one of the rare games we actually got the entire staff, you know, because in Quake, you know, like the older staff didn't play that, but at least with Age of Empires, we even got, you know, the old, you know, old timers to play that game. And that was when we had 8 people. We even had Charlotte played one game of Age of Empires.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah, the editorial. Actually, in those days, the editor-in-chief actually had an assistant.
Wow.
That's how big the staff was. Yeah.
Yes.
And so, and we got her to play too. Yeah. Yeah. That was the game where, We all kept aging up, and, you know, we were, you know, in the near the end game of Age of Empires, like early on, and the guy who was the strategy game editor at the time, so, you know, the guy who ostensibly would be the best. I don't know if he listens to our podcast.
I don't know if he does, but I'd be running through his Stone Age cavemen with my bronze cavalry just chopping him to pieces.
Right. The guy's still in the Stone Age. How you get up there so fast. What you doing? Dude. Strategy editor.
Did anyone ever use hacks internally in one of those matches just to piss someone off?
No, we don't. I don't need hacks.
Well, I'm not saying you, but maybe someone. Maybe
no.
Shit talking guy
maybe
like that
Dave
got
fellow.
Insanely irate. Yeah.
No, I don't think anyone ever.
I don't think we.
No one ever resorted to cheating. That was a much simpler time back in the 1800s when we used to.
Dave just called everybody cheaters.
Battle with the fisticuffs and all that.
Yeah, I don't think we actually had cheating.
No, yes, we did not.
You would just claim cheating.
Well, camping was cheating.
Camping was cheating. Sniping was cheating.
Yes.
Yeah.
Anything that killed you last was cheating.
Yeah. Joe Valina, he was...
Rushing was definitely cheating.
Yeah.
Turtling was cheating.
Danny Atkin was the classic turtler.
Yes. He'd want to hole up and wait.
He was crazy. He in Age of Empires, he was the classic turtler. He would build a city and then wall it in like... You know, walls. It would be impossible. And then he would build the wonder.
Yeah, he'd try to build a wonder.
And, you know, a notice would come up. Because if you build a wonder...
You win.
So...
You don't win instantly. We have time.
You don't win instantly. It takes a while to build it. But a notice would come up, you know... Player Danny is building a wonder. And so at that point, in the meantime, the rest of us are all fighting all over the map. And then that notice would come up and we'd all be, fuck, everybody go on Danny. Yeah. And often he won because he was so freaking walled in, there was no way to get to
him. By the time we knew.
He never left his base. He would play every multiplayer game. He'd never leave. His whole map must have been a fog of war.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's cheating.
That's why I like
these game mechanics are cheating.
That's why I like victory point setups in RTS.
Yeah, Company of Heroes is such a good fix for that. Yeah.
Didn't that have an option to turn off the Wonder Victory?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, you could. But
he wouldn't let you.
Danny wouldn't play with us.
He wouldn't play. We play the way that I will win at. That was like, were you on staff when Dave? I had this like sort of weird. The only game I ever actually had this weird like. Actual innate good talent for a multiplayer was Interstate 76 multiplayer.
Yeah, that game
do you remember
was awesome.
That?
Yeah. Love
I actually
game.
Ended up being really good at that. And I used to play Dave all the time, and it would piss him off.
Oh, he would get so angry that you beat him. So angry.
Yeah, because he couldn't deal with the fact that I could beat him at something, because I was just like, the carpet for everybody in every game. So he always knew he could get frags off Jeff. So he and I would play Interstate 76, and I could totally kick his ass. And he got so fucking mad that he wanted to find another car game to beat me at, because he couldn't beat me at that one.
Did he like really try to justify it and talk about how scrubby that game was and how it, you know, was impure, that there was no that it favored chance?
Well, he would always have Dave, if you're listening, you know I love you, man.
That's the thing. You know, we loved working with everyone.
We do. He really is a great guy. Yes. But you know, your sportsmanship needs a little bit. he would always find there'd be some excuse why, you know. Yeah, Interstate 76, you know, it wasn't fair or whatever. I never won clean in anything, but I would always beat him. So anyway, he decided he had to beat me in another vehicle game because he couldn't beat me in that one. So we decided we were going to play Need for Speed, and he was going to beat me there. Maybe you were still on staff, I don't know. But he would...
I think I was, yeah.
He would... basically, all he did was memorize one track only, and he got it to where he was perfect on that track. And at this point, like, I hadn't played it at all that much, but he would only play me on that track. And I was like, dude, let's have it all things be equal. Let's go to a track where neither of us know it. And he wouldn't do it. He'd only play in the track where he could kick my ass. Wow. Like, okay. All right. You win again, Dave. Good for you.
Plays these things.
Yay, you won. It's like,
we need to publicize that victory around the office.
Yes!
Yeah.
I got green! Yeah, it's like playing with your 2-year-old and letting him win in checkers. Yay, you won! Yay!
Anyway, oh, man.
Love you, Dave.
Yeah.
Ellie Chin, you need to go back to work.
I need to go or else my shiny Prius is going to get towed.
Yeah, go make money for Sega.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you for indulging in CGW nostalgia.
Well, walk down memory lane, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
And whatever the hell you're working on at Sega, I hope it's going well. You have any big announcements for us?
Right here to announce on the 1UP show?
Yeah.
Yeah?
No, on GFW
radio. On GFW
radio? Yeah.
Radio?
2006 edition.
2006. September 16th, 2006, yeah.
Come up with a game from 2006 that you're announcing.
Yeah. Yes, Medieval 2, Total War.
Okay.
That one
coming out in 2007.
Yeah. Yeah, nothing we can talk about here, but, you know, maybe you guys come by Gamers Day. And
are we invited?
You should be. I mean, you guys are still, you know, certifiable editorial.
We are,
aren't you?
Yeah. We're full time editors for OneUp.com.
Yeah. Yeah. Then you guys should come over and check out some good games.
All right. You guys have done right by the PC in recent days. So.
Indeed.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Stay tuned for more news on Empire and stuff like that. Space Siege.
Bugs Steve Grohl. We want to find out about aliens.
Oh, aliens.
We want to basically do our own story on it rather than
a PC story for aliens. Yeah, absolutely.
And or anything console. I mean, all the lineup that I'm aware of. That, you know, you've got a
Alpha Total Protocol. War the Obsidian guys are working on their
RPG,
their spy RPG,
oh, right.
modern day RPG, and that's got, you know, it's a 360 and PS3 SKU, but also PC.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's it called?
Sounds cool to me.
Alpha Protocol.
Alpha Protocol.
Oh, that's right. That was the one that was on
GI.
Cover of GI.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to, you know what? That was like, I wanted to read that story, and the issue we got, it had a printing error.
So that's right. It did.
It was gone.
So I had the cover, and I'm like, this sounds cool. And I read like a synopsis online. I'm like, this actually sounds like a, you know, nice, you know, new approach to, or fresh approach to RPG making. But
cool. Yeah.
Pages weren't there. So.
Check it out. Read it.
Awesome. Hard.
Yeah.
All right. So thank you,
Elliot,
guys, for having me, and we'll chat soon.
Yes, we will. All Thanks right. for being here. We're going to take a break and be right back. Then we're back. You guys all done chewing now?
No.
You guys are eating the most like gnarly looking shit I've ever seen.
Hey, this stuff's awesome.
Kinda like day glow looking sour tongue tinglers are called. And I guess they're like gummy bears in the shape of pacifiers.
It's not gummy bear.
I thought they were Sour Patch Kids, but the texture is way different. It's a lot.
Special request. And
we actually do want to thank the fellow who sent these in to us as a kind of a thank you, a GFW thank you.
I'm hugely thankful for them because I think they were supposed to go to me, but because they were addressed to you, now it's like they're in everyone's care and I get to have a few. But I specifically mentioned somehow, I don't know, like International Candy came up on one of our threads because people were talking about like going over to Tim Hortons in Canada. Having their donuts and coffee. So I mentioned, you know, I used to live at the Canadian border in Washington State, how much I love their candy there in Vancouver. It's kind of like the grass is greener thing because people there are like, oh, man, I want to go get a Snickers or something. And like, yeah, I'm just all bored of that. And they're these specifically, these sour pacifiers, it's like the texture that Sean doesn't like is what I like, that they're super kind of like a stale jujube.
I was about to say it's got that jujube feel.
But like it's
stuck in my teeth forever.
And sour in a way that like shames Sour Patch Kids, which are also from Canada, I think, in the first place. And they're awesome. And I mentioned it on the message board.
And here they are.
And lo and behold, they arrived not only that, but in a package that was wrapped up in the infamous vampire cover of Computer Gaming World magazine.
Right.
So that was pretty awesome.
The nice guy who sent it to us is
Give them to me.
Aaron Simmer from the website The Armchair Empire. And Aaron has done a bunch of interviews with me over the years, I think starting from before I was
I didn't
editor
know
chief.
This.
Yeah, every year on his website he would interview me until I think at one year I actually stopped emailing him back just because I'm an ass.
He's got a. He must have
so I'm sorry, Aaron.
On the NeoGAF forums, then, because this is that's where I was like posting and talking.
Okay,
with him.
Reconnect.
So you need to connect the dots and see.
Yeah,
see what
let's
this
hook
tag
up again, Aaron. It was all my fault. It wasn't you. It was me. So thanks for the candy.
I used to live in Buffalo, and we used to get certain select Canadian candies.
Yeah,
but
across the falls.
Not that one. We used to get the Smarties, which are the. In America, those Smarties are, you know, tart sugar things.
M&M's.
Canada,
They're
M&M's.
It's like Canadian M&M.
Yeah. Very strange. That used to baffle me.
They got a Cadbury Flake.
I can't deal with the texture either. I just can't. I can't do it.
I haven't been
It's very jujube-ish.
Canada.
Which I never liked.
Well, I need to go there.
I like Canada.
Ryan, who didn't say much in the first half, mainly was because he was chewing.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's done now,
so thank
though.
You for the sour tongue tinglers.
So we got a few things on our agenda today. One of them, Sean, you made a pretty lengthy post on the blogs this week about the reaction to Ngai Kroll's post about the Resident Evil 5 trailer and the what he believed was racist imagery in that trailer, and you made your own comments about that and the reaction to his comments. And
That's like a
and there's a debate
that's been going on since E3 of last year.
Well, it came back up because there's, you know, another trailer was issued.
Mm-hmm.
And so the story that we're talking about appeared on MTV's multiplayer. I think that's another, you know, online blog as
well.
Yeah. And Guy Kroll's Newsweek Level Up blogger. And basically it was an interview with him and someone at the MTV site just about this trailer. And they'd been having this discussion about, you know, just, I think, race and games in general. And then out of it, they decided that this would, you know, merit its, and, you know, wisely decided that this would merit its own story. And because it was, it's sort of kicked off like just this huge, I would like to say debate, but I don't know. It's gotten a lot of attention and a lot of reaction online. What Kroll, you know, hopefully I'm getting this right. He took issue with, and again, this is specifically about imagery in the trailer. This is not saying that the game is racist or that the game is, you know, going to be, but that there's specific, that there's imagery that has, you know, a potentially racist baggage as it's presented in this one single trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason I say a lot of reaction, not necessarily debate, is because a lot of times, I mean, I like to think that, you know, in the age of all these new, you know, new video technologies, where you have text messaging and the ability to blog, and all these new forums for people to communicate in, it lacks a certain something in just old-fashioned conversation, you know, and we're used to this, and not just that people are dicks, but sometimes there's just a total disconnect between commentary and response. So that, you know, for example, if you post, you know, like in my blog, one thing I wanted to point out was that, you know, for everyone that says, well, if it's simply the fact that there are black zombies in this game that's offending this guy, you know, he's got to be a wuss because we've blown the shit out of Spanish zombies in Resident Evil 4 and in, you know, white, Chinese and black or whatever, like people of all, you know, nationalities and ethnicities, or, well, ethnicities rather than the same American nationality in previous Resident Evil games. And so, you know, part of this blog that I made was to emphasize why there's a different context and how important that context is. And I'll get to that in a second, but then it's like, so you take all the time to do this, and then some of the first responses are like, well, yeah, but we already played games where you could shoot up Spaniards and whites in Resident Evil, so what's the point? It's like, wait a minute.
What?
This blog was a reaction to that reaction, and then here we come again.
Full circle.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a whole other thing altogether. But what he's getting at is that it's in the same way. One example, I'll use a different example than the one I use in my blog. Say if you just have, like if there was a Japanese-made game right now, or and it was basically set in China, it doesn't matter what period. It could be the 40s, it could be now. I mean, it could be the 30s, or it could be today. And it basically involves, you know, a Japanese guy, and he's doing nothing but shooting up a bunch of Chinese zombies the whole time. That is different, and that context does matter, and it's going to be read differently by different people than if it were a Japanese guy in a, you know, in a Danish village or something with a bunch of Danish zombies. And that, of course, is because of the history of you know, of Japanese invasion of Manchuria and then the rest of China. And so again, because there's this notion of, I mean, just an angry black mob, and this comes up all over. You know, I mean, this is we're used to it in the headlines currently with Darfur, the recent past with what happened in Rwanda. The imagery of it is associated all the way back with antebellum America and just the fear of slaveholders of slave uprisings and stuff.
Right.
It's come again, in popular imagery through the Watts riots, through the civil rights, you know, after Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Right.
Everything from, you know, Katrina and stuff. I mean, these fears and these general, you know, just scenes where you have a bunch of black people.
Right, the Rodney King riots.
Running riot.
Right.
And because of that fear and that imagery, even if people aren't able to specifically pinpoint all these things, you know, another one would be, you know, the Battle of Mogadishu.
Right.
People are familiar with it, with Black Hawk Down.
Yep.
So that's there. And I think when part of the, you know, when they're making this game, they know that, you know, the developers at Capcom know that if we have this imagery, it's not going to be just the same as here's just a change of scenery, that this is going to be evocative. And, you know, it's going to, you know, like move people, and it's going to fascinate some people. It's going to scare other people and stuff. But part of that is because of all of this history,
the cultural baggage,
right. And they're drawing on that. And so part of the point I was making is that, I mean, this could be okay. The other thing, the main thing about this is that I try to outline where, you know, our perspectives on it might differ a little bit in my blog, but I don't think anyone here was saying, oh my God, this is an outrage. No one was outraged about this in the first place. And I think a lot of the responses kind of assume that if you're bringing up race, that you must be just out, you must be downright indignant. I mean, it's like you are ready to go to war over this. And instead, it's more of just a really, you know, hopefully just a measured and thoughtful response to, hey, you know, looking at this, here's some of the things that are interesting about this. A big part of the reaction, I mean, I'll let you guys jump in, but it seems to be that the people are so used to looking at games as nothing but escapism, and purely escapism, and they can't see how something could be both escapism but can also have implicit messages in it and can also be worth discussing in a way other than what happened when you pressed this button and whether or not you were compelled when you pressed that button.
Right.
And for us, I think whatever our backgrounds, you know, mine and N guys, I mean, we're very used to this thing. You know, you can watch like Toy Story or something. At the same time, you're like, doesn't that look cool? Do you see, like, you know, the reflection on the spaceman's helmet? And you're like, oh, this is also interesting. You have something to do with cowboys being this hero for boys and stuff. And then it's moving on to astronauts. And there's some stuff going on there. It's not just that there's... And because if you were to step in and make some comment about, hey, pay a little bit of attention to the specificity of these toys and the roles they're playing in this movie, it doesn't mean you're not having fun with it. Doesn't mean you can't enjoy it. And that's not even a bad thing. But I think a lot of the audience online is just not used to that in the least bit. So they get really defensive, and they're also, you know, rightly so, rightly used to becoming defensive about games because they're attacked in such ridiculous and egregious ways on, you know, on the news networks and
Part of you kind of wants to say, like, hey, don't everything give them fuel for the fire, you know, don't criticize it for racism because then you're going to get
get those people riled up.
Yeah, the yahoos riled up.
Yeah, that just, you know, suppresses rational conversations.
Right.
I mean, which is. The problem with discussing anything like racism or sexism or, you know, homophobia on the internet is it's so tied in with people's identities. Mm-hmm. And on the internet, it's so easy to not have an identity. So you can't even... You don't know anything about the person who's responding to your responses.
Right,
you can't,
sure.
You can't, you know, assume anything about them. You can't... You have no idea what their perspective is, what their background is.
And that's hugely important. Yeah. I mean, the shared assumptions that you can have when you have a conversation with someone... I mean, Jeff and I, everyone in this room, we know each other well enough. But, like, say I were just the first time I met N guy. Maybe after about talking with him about whatever it may be for about 10 minutes, I'm already to the point where I'm assuming certain things about him, about his education, about his familiarity. If I could talk about this and I won't have to preface it with like a base level introduction to the concepts that I'm about to allude to. And people work with this way in a face-to-face conversation all the time. But then when you take that away and then you start jumping in, you're like, wait, maybe I have to back this up because maybe some people aren't even aware somehow in American history that among the various types, and, you know, I make sure to underscore that these are revolting, and the various types of minstrels and sambos and all these things, that there is this notion of the savage, you know, and this angry, just violent force that's sort of just there beneath civilized society waiting to come out and just tear everything to shit. And so some people that are not aware of this, I mean, maybe they're born in the 1980s and they have no understanding. I mean, even though if they're born in the 80s, in their lifetime, plenty of shit's happened to let them see that this is actually a type, you know, a stereotype. But I mean, if you have a longer reach, just by, you know, doing, you know, education will help you out and stuff. But it's like you go online and you make these comments. You can't assume that everyone has got that background. So you got to back it up. Wait a minute. If I'm going to have this conversation, do I have to start with that? With a detailed breakdown of some of these things that we're going to then allude to in this discussion that are going to inform it. That's pretty...
Right. I think it was N guy who said it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was a point he made, or it might have been you, I forget, but that helped me understand why... Because I definitely felt that way. I definitely felt, way back when I saw the first one, you know, before it started becoming a meme or whatever, like, that was my gut reaction. Like, whoa, that's some kind of messed up imagery. And the point I read this morning about it was that the village itself has this kind of ominous, creepy, dark overtone to it without even the zombie part.
And that's that you, drawing
that
very
you,
much.
That you don't see, like, kids playing or moms or whatever. That completely draws into this idea of, like, you know, the scary, savage village.
Right.
That's before you even get to the zombie part.
Where you assume it is, you know, a third world country. You already have that assumption that that's where this is taking place.
Right. Yeah, and the people are in the shadows.
And you could say that the people at Capcom, you know, the Japanese developers of this game, and they're clearly drawing on tropes that are used in horror, you know, films and horror storytelling. So it's like, you know, imagine if it was all whatever. Everyone in the trailer was of the same color or something, you know, but you would look at it differently, you know. But it's like, they're, even though that's kind of an excuse, it's like, yes, we this is what all horror movies do. Again, it's like,
right.
This is very difficult to talk about, but again, like, okay, the part of what he was reacting to is he was calling the way that everyone is ominous and othered, you know, in sort of a grad school speak of how the people are before they're zombies. And they could have done something differently by, you know, say Chris Redfield, the character's walking through the town, and instead of everyone is sort of just on these tracks and there's no interaction between anyone, what if some kids are playing ball and the ball rolled toward Chris and he kicks it back to him? And it's like, even something as simple as that would then say that there's some connection. These are all people.
Right. We the game makers, are assuming that these people are actually people and normal.
And maybe they are. We're looking at 30 seconds of a trailer.
And that's true.
And
we're talking about is the reaction to this particular piece of film,
which they consciously chose to represent their game as, like, the first thing people see about this game. So, I mean, that, you know.
And it's challenging because they don't want to show their hand and give away too much of the story and reassure you that, like, oh, well, maybe this game is, like, 90% of the time you're playing, you know, this character, a black character who's, like, from the same area, and he's working with all these other people, and that there are all these ramifications of, you know, whatever angle they end up taking with the zombie angle and the story and stuff. I mean, all that could be there, but it's kind of like they could have done that for the trailer. Here's another thing to point out. You know, when you first saw it, you were disturbed or something by it.
I wasn't necessarily disturbed.
But it was like, I was very aware of the fact that when I watched it, I had a different reaction to it than I would when I looked at the trailers for Resident Evil 4. Mm-hmm. And thinking about, well, why does it feel different? Do you feel a little bit like, I mean, do you feel uneasy about it? Do you feel, I mean, why does it have this extra impact? And I think that part of the things that we've been bringing up, that's part of the explanation. Because you are on some level aware of the baggage attached to this imagery.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I mean, when I watched it, I was aware that, like, the distinction between racist and using race, I guess, is the key there. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, this is clearly aware that, or at least it should be, that it is using racial imagery. But I wasn't necessarily taking the next step that this is, like, a horrible thing. I just was like, okay, that's very intriguing. I would like to know how they actually handle it in the whole thing, which maybe is what they were going for in a trailer. You know what I mean? Like, maybe they just, you know, didn't go about it the right way. But my reaction was, I hope there actually is some more to this, and I want to actually play this because I've kind of been, my buttons have been pushed that way. And I'm my interest is piqued. You know?
I absolutely agree. I think another element of it is that people see it and they say, well, why do you want to, like, read all this politics into, I mean, why should this game have to be concerned with explaining itself from a sociological perspective and, you know, political point of view? And the counterpoint that I would make is that the game is already contains, you know, this implicit sociological, historical, and cultural messages because of the decisions it's made. And it's not like you have to say, well, we're going to make a game that's about, you know, this is kind of a lead into something we're going to talk about later in the show. You have to make a game that's about issues. It's an issue game. But stuff is just in there. I mean, anything that's a cultural product is just by default going to have some investment in of values. You know,
if you make the decision to set the game in a real world setting with real world people, and you're gonna add elements like race to the picture, you don't get a free pass. You know, if you're going to send it in, you know, magic fairyland, you know, pony world, then okay. But once you start making those decisions, things have to get analyzed that way. There's no, you don't get out of it.
Right.
You know, I just.
Right. And there's also the, again, going back to the, we don't know what this game is and what,
yes,
what it's trying to say, if anything.
Let's stress that.
We're hoping it says things we like.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also the disconnect, perhaps, and maybe there isn't a disconnect here, but in movie land, the people cutting the trailers are not the director of the movie or the writer of the movie.
Right.
It's some guy who has been tasked to make 30 seconds of enticing footage.
Right.
And it's usually someone completely separate from that. And I don't know. I think with game development, it's probably someone in-house, but it might not be, you know, the person who's in charge of guiding the whole vision. So it might have, and I don't know for a fact, that maybe the director of the game did cut this trailer, but maybe there's just two separate people working here.
Mm-hmm.
And like the guy who over at Capcom was just like, you released that to represent my game?
And there might just be complete unawareness whatsoever. I mean, I think it doesn't detract at all from Engai's point, though,
right,
which is that the baggage is just there, like,
right,
and you got to deal with the fact that it is there. You can't blow off the baggage,
and you can. And if you don't, if you legitimately don't take any issue with it, and you see it, and it means nothing to you, it's no different than if it were any, you know, if they were purple zombies or yellow or green or whatever. Then maybe that's the case, and you could make a case for yourself. But that doesn't mean that like Engai's wrong.
Right.
When given his experience, you know, and given his perspective, if he feels uneasy by it. But again, the key point is that he's not telling people to boycott this game based on the trailer. He's not, you know, trying to dissuade someone from buying it. All he's trying to do is encourage people to think about how they're reacting to it.
Right.
And that shouldn't be threatening at all. I mean, why should
it be
so threatening? And the responses, that's what, when some of them are so venomous, that seems weird.
I mean, if people want games to be perceived as art or whatever, and they think games can be art, then these are the exact kind of, you know, topics that art touches upon and draws upon and, you know, reflects.
And even stuff that's not art, like if you have, take a television commercial, the most crass television commercial, it might very well have a number, it might have a number of implicit meanings in the way that it's put together that are still there, even though it's not trying to make any kind of message whatsoever.
Sure.
Maybe it's just trying to sell a product. But, I mean, if it's like,
blonde people are happier.
Yeah, I mean, and when you have enough things like this, you know, or, you know, if, I'm trying to think if you, there's an example that I don't agree with, but I mean, there's been like controversy over, like, say there's an advertisement. This is a specific one for Kentucky Fried Chicken, and it was like, it was just mom and the kids, and some people were like, well, this is just being representative of a large portion of the audience. And other people are like, well, no, it's not. It's saying it's a normative statement. It's not like a descriptive statement. And there's all these things, but those are still there. I mean, everything, whether right or wrong, I mean, that's
right. That's why the conversation ensued, is because people saw that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Another thing about this is like, if you have enough pop cultural points of, you know, reference where like Black Hawk Down and you know, games like this come out, and then over time what happens, I think, is younger people are just sort of used to seeing these, and they just become a convention or a trope.
Yeah.
And then after a while, for some people, they just become divorced from the context of where did this imagery arise from in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of lose that. I mean, for me, it's like I mentioned in the blog, it's like, well, you're borrowing, you're taking, you know, you're using the impact of this imagery to help make your game, you know, to lend the extra degree of, you know, impact to your game, but you're not acknowledging any of the baggage involved with it. And that was a bad thing. And some people were like, well, what? You think that Resident Evil 4 is supposed to explain Darfur has nothing to do with it? And that's ridiculous. Of course not. What an example of acknowledging it would be, like in the example, in the case I provide, would be that if Redfield kicked the ball back at a kid and it was just kind of like, hey, it's a kid playing ball. Here's your ball, kid.
Right.
Like, that would be an example of acknowledging that, like, okay, that these are people. It's not, and that there are reasons. No matter, I mean, how barbaric and brutal the real scenarios are, or ones that are just largely just based on xenophobia or just fear, and they're entirely unwarranted. That in all of these circumstances, there's like more of a story than just this. What these people do,
right?
And you're talking about like changing, like say that image of Chris kicking the ball back was in there. Like, mm-hmm. 1 second of chosen footage could have changed the entire context of this thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Their meaning.
Right.
People would have seen different things in it.
Yeah. And again, maybe it is there.
Because I think maybe the reading, the sensing is, like, if you see, you know, you look in this trailer and you see heroes walking through the town and everyone's kind of in the shadows and everyone's doing their own thing and looking at him, and when they show them and the ominous music's playing, and this is part of the horror movie, you know, standard that we were talking about. So you take what they'll do is, like, you know, a Hitchcock or something, we'll take just a really normal scenario and make it ominous and frightening.
Sure.
But then when you're doing it here, what ends up happening to this, you know, implicit message I keep referring to is that the people in the scene don't suddenly just go from being normal to becoming zombies. It was like there's a bunch of, like, zombies waiting to happen here.
Yes.
Now their true selves are coming out. Now they've changed to the you know, the potential danger has now become the actual danger.
Right. I had an interesting experience when I was sick, and my wife and kid would bring home movies, and at the time we were going through this little, my daughter's 14, and I thought it would be fun to watch some of the 1980s John Hughes teen movies. I figured she was old enough for the Ferris Bueller's Day Off and all that. So one of the movies we got was 16 Candles, which in my mind, from memory, was very funny. And I thought it would be great. It's got a female protagonist who's a redhead, like my daughter, so I thought she'd identify with Molly Ringwald. So we got 16 Candles, and we watched it. Do you guys all remember this movie?
Yeah. Yep.
Well, we get, you know, 15, 20 minutes into the movie, and along comes the character Long Duck Dong.
Yeah.
You know? And
what's happening, hot stuff.
And watching it now in 2008, do you remember what they did every single time in every scene when you first see him?
No.
Do you remember?
No, I don't remember.
On the soundtrack, there's a gong.
Oh, shit.
Every single time.
Like a...
yeah. Basically, it's like... Bong, you know? Every time. And to watch it in 2008 with my 14-year-old daughter, who is, you know, a pretty aware kid living in Berkeley, I mean, I didn't have to say a word. She was like, Dad, this movie's totally racist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it ruined the whole experience. I mean, we ended up finishing it, but we stopped laughing and enjoying the movie because this character kept ruining the movie for us.
Yeah.
And you know, and everything he says is like, you know, oh, sorry, mister, whatever, you know. And it's the most, like, grating thing. And this movie, and the thing that got me, though, is this movie is not that old.
No, it's not.
But at that time, in 1984, it was still okay to do that. You know, that at that point, the accepted wisdom was you could have an Asian character, apparently, you can have an Asian character in a movie in this country, give him a stupid-ass name that's going to make us giggle. Oh, it's like penis. And you can and you can even have the convince this Asian actor to read these lines in this offensive way.
Yep. I mean, we had the same—I mean, this is an older movie, but I remember— I was on, like, a classic movie kick, and then we rented Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yeah, well, that's the other... That one's
and
worse.
I had no idea that was in there.
Yeah, that's
and
worse.
And then you get...
Oh, jeez.
Was it Mickey Rooney?
It's Mickey Rooney.
Mickey Rooney dressed up as an Asian, and he keeps going... He's got, like, big buck teeth.
Yeah, big buck teeth.
And he keeps calling her Holly Go Rightly, and her name is Holly Go Lightly. And, like, this is, like, the joke the whole time. And we were just sitting there going, oh, my God. And that's, like, the only thing I remember about this movie now.
Yeah, which is still...
It's supposed to be, like,
it's considered a classic. Yeah, it's got Audrey Hepburn in it in her prime.
Truman Capote book.
Right, it's a Truman Capote book. It's considered a classic. And right in the middle of this classic movie, you've got Mickey Rooney dressed up with buck teeth talking in, you know, fake Asian talk. So, I mean...
Did he have the big goggle glasses on?
Yeah,
it's all but that, yeah. I mean, you go ahead 20 years and you're at 16 Candles, so at least they still have an Asian actor doing it. That was the advance they made, but they're still calling him Long Duck Dong.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I guess just the point relating back is that, you know, that baggage existed all the way up through the 80s, that it was okay to just make a movie where you can just make fun of Asian people.
Right.
You know? And then there's, you know, the obvious, like... The Simpsons or whatever, where everyone is a target and suddenly it's not so bad. Like, if you do see the same stereotypes, like, you know, Apu is obviously, you know, the convenience store owner who's Indian. But if you have a whole collection of stereotypes, suddenly that makes it okay.
Right.
But, like, if you just have one, it sticks out like a sore...
And the collection of stereotypes and just sort of the collection, you know, the aggregate of these...
things are telling over time, you know, mm-hmm. largely in retrospect too. I mean, what pop cultural, you know, some books, magazines, movies, games and stuff choose as their villains sure. often turns out to be telling in the long run. Like, of course, in the second Cold War, I mean, in the during the second Red Scare and during the Cold War, there, you know, were all these things like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and you have, you know, and stuff that was parodied like in Dr. Strangelove with, you know, the mm-hmm. communists trying to get your precious bodily fluids and mm-hmm. stuff. But you have all these, you look at it and you're like, oh, giant insects and stuff after the atomic age.
Sure.
And all these, what are we afraid of? And so you look and it's like, well, it's a movie about a giant ant. Like, what are you trying to say? It has mm-hmm. something to do with culture and that people are maybe afraid of, like, the dawn of the nuclear age and things going, you know, the atomic age and things mm-hmm. going crazy, you know? And then you look at games for the longest time, it meant Russian attack and stuff, you know?
Sure.
There was, like, the commies. That was the, you know, Rambo sure. and stuff like that. And the commies were the enemies. Then, like, for the longest time now, in a great many games, it's, you know, Arab enemies.
What's great, though, is that Nazis never go out of style. You know,
that's why.
Fads will come and go. Sure, your Russians are bad guys for a while. Then you got your Middle Easterns. But the Nazis will always be around for us to hate. Warms the heart.
So, God, I'm like, I don't know what to say because I'm also sick of reading any preview that has to do with, like, that starts off with killing Nazis never gets old. There's many of those. So, like, yeah, just, I mean, maybe there's some future. I don't imagine that there's going to be, like, some trend that, like, you know, Resident Evil is the start of the new, you know, whatever the city, if it turns out to be in Haiti or something, or if it turns out to actually be in Africa, it's in fact in, you know, Somalia or whatever, it's going to be the start of a trend like that. But I think it's worth looking at. What are we, yeah. who are we making our enemies in these games? And then not only that, I think the point's just as valid. So some people are like, well, why would you be just pissed off about this game? And no one says anything about all these other games. Call of Duty 4 came up. It's like, well, yeah, actually when it did came up, it was a point I had. And I remember talking with Rory. We're like, well, because you can't have, you know, because there's no one in this game world other than just these angry, you know, later on Russians, but there's just these angry Arab dudes with guns and you shoot them and you're going through houses and buildings and offices and stuff. There's no one in there that doesn't have a gun that's trying to kill you. Like, well, there's an implicit message in here that this world is popular, that Saudi Arabia, they call it something else that's unnamed in the game, is got nothing but dudes who want to kill you in it, you know, and they're plenty of people who do want to kill you there, I'm sure. But it's like, it's just a side effect of the way it is. Part of it's technology. You know, if you're going to have, it's very easy to have just an enemy and his AI is to run out to this one point of cover and then wait there and then shoot at you and try to kill you. And then when you kill him, to have his clone run out from the same spawn closet and do the same thing. It's easier to do that than it is to have, you know, someone screaming and freaking out and hiding when you're running through their house in the middle of a firefight. And then not only that, then that poses this other host of problems. Like, well, what happens if you accidentally shoot them? Are you making a game that depicts, you know, American and British soldiers as just indiscriminate, you know, war criminals? Then do you have to punish them and make the game start over and piss off? And then are you, like, having directly negative consequences on gameplay because of it? So there's all these reasons that you're like, that limit you and that make your, that help control what the game is, other than just like, well, we don't want to do it or we want to do it. I mean, there's a big bunch of reasons behind it, but it also means that games in some ways aren't the best suited for these really thorough looks at you know, big issue things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this, we could use to lead into
very nice segue, Sean.
NPR topic.
Very nice.
So today is All Things Considered on National Public Radio. There's a quick segment, and their summary of it is that some say video game makers are squandering their cultural clout by not making games that contribute to the national conversation about important issues such as the war in Iraq or teen pregnancy. The segment then...
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh. I was just trying to imagine a teen pregnancy, video game. Let's move on.
Let's see
that. So part of the discussion, you know, that they had little sound bites from, you know, taken from interviews, and they had Harvey Smith, who worked on Midway's Area 51 Blacksite. I might have it backwards. Yeah, Blacksite Area 51. And they sort of said that, what was it? Part of it was like, games cost a great deal of money to make, AAA games and stuff, and it's like, you really do need to be concerned with the bottom line, and is making a game that has something significant to say or has, you know, some, is eager to participate in the so-called national conversation about an important issue, is that going to help it recover the investment
costs
to
yeah.
make that? Or is it going to be that if it's a shooter like Blacksite, the shooting part works? And that was what was kind of my problem with Blacksite, is that mm-hmm. it wanted to do some interesting things with its plot, but the game itself was a piece of shit. So all that was kind of like pointless and right. lost, because mm-hmm. no one's going to want to play it in the first place to even care what they're
get
trying to
get
say.
The message out of yeah. this piece you know, of crap game. Yeah.
So that did come up. I think that was fair.
The point that I thought that they missed in the NPR story, which disappointed me, was the fact that you know, in the movie industry in 2007 and even 6, you had one movie come out about the Iraq War after another, and they all tanked. I mean, it was.
Did they though?
In terms of box office, they did. Mm-hmm. In the Valley of whatever it was called, all these movies kind of came and went. Nobody went to see them. So I felt that.
Well, because I'm thinking of like, I mean, there's some distance between them. So there was. Jarhead came out, did really well. That was about the Persian, mm-hmm. the first
yeah, that's
Iraq
a little
war.
Older.
But that came out after
political movies
the invasion.
Come out and are successful.
Yeah,
they are. But like in this current environment, like in the last year, these movies did not do well.
But were those good movies? I don't know anything about.
Well, the Valley, whatever. I mean, that's the one that got Tommy Lee Jones an Oscar nomination for what that's worth.
I missed that one.
But we'll see. I mean, the
Syriana was like, I think that was probably, people were afraid it was going to be a little too preachy and a little too preachy, like to the left.
Yeah, that was the mm-hmm. the Tom Cruise, Robert Redford, Meryl Streep one, The Lions for Lambs. I mean, there's a bunch of examples of these movies that people didn't go to see, which, I mean, my point being that it's not like in every other art form, you've got these
surefire hits,
right? Based on real world complicated issues,
mm-hmm. right?
But we know people,
or that people actually want to deal with that when they're trying to get entertained.
I think people want to deal with at least the context. I mean, look at the success of Call of Duty 4.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Gamers really want to do they
well,
want
with the context.
With the context. They're right. super fascinated by it. I mean, and you look at the responses. I mean, a lot of people like it more. And I don't think it's just because you could shoot through walls in this iteration of the series. I think a lot of it has to do with that. You think about it, and you're in a certain age group, and you know, these themes fascinate you.
Resonate.
This
right.
is, yeah.
But do we want education? Do we want edutainment in our games? I mean, you start adding, you know, whiffs of, I'm going to teach you about these things in my game, and doesn't that start
well,
being
I mean, it's
an
all
immediate
in the presentation.
Turnoff?
If you're gonna be all, like, preachy,
right.
no. But if that's you present like it in a compelling way that is more of a story, then yes.
No, yeah, no one wants... If you told me the movie was a didactic, and I wouldn't be interested either. Because
right.
you don't want to. Like saying, like with Jarhead, that was a really good movie. You don't... Mm-hmm. It's not there to teach you a lesson. It's there to contribute to a conversation and encourage people to join in that conversation, to think about these themes and then talk about them. And so to that extent, I think games are doing it because there's a conversation is emerging even about just this trailer for Resident Evil 4. Mm-hmm. And it ties back into what I was saying about you don't have to necessarily try. It's not like you have to say this game has a message and I'm going to... This is a good chance to bring something up. Two weeks ago, I mentioned reading Ted Rall in the context of talking about Biscacci, and a few people were like, oh, God, you read him? What the fuck is wrong with you? And that was like really surprising for me to see because I was like, is the assumption that to read any material to say that you condone and advocate everything in here wholeheartedly, that's an idiot's literacy. No one
right,
does that.
Yeah.
Any good reading is argumentative through and through. The whole time right. you're reading it, you're engaging with it, and you're like, so no, because
right.
something is on my bookshelf, it's now my Bible.
Right, yeah, I could read Mein Kampf.
Yeah,
right?
And it doesn't mean anything. Like that. Yeah,
yeah, when you open the cover, you're not signing a contract to say I am going to agree with everything I'm about to read.
Yeah.
This does not happen.
And then sometimes, yeah, like if the book is doing absolutely nothing but preaching to you as a choir, it can be very boring. You know, I mean,
yeah.
I like books where I have really heated responses to them. Like,
mm-hmm.
Last night, it was almost like I almost wanted to talk out loud to a book I'm reading because it was pissing me off so much. But at the same time, turn a page, I'm like, okay, I really like that. You know, I'm mm-hmm. just going back and forth. But so to take it back
is
to
it
the
porn?
Point,
good
let's
book is a
no, it's Susan Jacoby's The Age of American Unreason. We'll talk about later. Part of what was getting me so upset is because her wholesale dismissal of video games as anything but just a junk activity through and
uh-huh.
through.
Right.
And she just like beats the shit out of Johnson for his Everything Bad is Good for You.
Oh, yeah.
And all these other things, yeah. And, I mean, she's got some points, but at the same time, in that case, I mean, for every good point she's making on another page, it's like, seriously, you haven't played a game. And you're not aware. I mean, you've done some, clearly done some research, a little bit of research about games and the kind of games that are out there, mm-hmm. but not much. Mm-hmm. And this is just, like, frankly, I'm in the process of, I think, of writing her a long letter. But anyway, I want to, for this NPR thing, there's some good feedback on our message boards on the 1UP forums. And I want to, like, just read a few snippets and maybe see how you guys react to them. So, Perry Good and True, his reaction was that you can't just have fun anymore. Everything requires substance. This is struck through. It says everything requires an agenda. That's what they seem to insinuate. When they play hopscotch, the first number represents the number of people a minute who die from tobacco. The second two are the number of people who die a day in Iraq. The third is the number of animal species that go extinct each month. And the next set of two are the number of people diagnosed with AIDS in Africa in a week. The last number is how many tons of recyclable trash is not put in the proper container a day. It's not even a little fun to play. You don't need to validate your hobby beyond the fact that it's fun for you. Nobody plays to be moved by some deep statement. You play to play. Why the fuck would I want distressing real-world issues in my escape from the real world? Mm-hmm. Part of my answer to that is, like, again, go back to COD4.
Right.
It's totally fun escapism, but distressing issues are in there, you know?
They are. You don't have to think about them, though.
What do you do? The fucking nuke goes off and you die. Well, sorry, spoiler.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
Wah, wah.
Well, I'd say that...
Are we past the statute of limitations
on
CD4?
We are. This is game has sold many million copies by now. That qualifies as distressing.
No, that did have disturbing... There were a few in that game. There were. You're right.
There are many.
Yeah.
The very beginning of the game.
Yeah, I mean, the very beginning. Mm-hmm.
You're put in the point of view of someone who's beep.
Mm-hmm. And did you appreciate that? Or did you
That is a great example. You're right. Mm-hmm. COD4 is a great example, but I can't think of many more other than that, though.
Well, it's possible.
In recent times. But it is possible. Yes,
it's just not
possible,
very prevalent.
It's possible to do that and still be entertaining. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, there's Bioshock. I mean, you can go and play Bioshock and say, I love figuring out the best way to kill the Big Daddy.
Uh-huh.
I love finding out the quickest way to harvest this little sister.
Mm-hmm.
But then as you play it, the game also is saying many, many things. The various characters and their journals, the way that the world's constructed, the way that the different figures in this world are interacting with one another and the positions they're in, those are all making serious, significant statements, mm-hmm. thought-provoking statements. Mm-hmm. And it's like, this is what I mean. You can have the cake and eat it too, because it's just, or you can think about it afterward, right?
Mm-hmm. I just thought, that's purple. That's how I love Bioshock.
Are you sure you're not talking about Halo? What, purple?
Gold,
I mean,
I don't know.
And this isn't a lot of this discussion is about politics specifically. But, like, if you look at, like, a game like Silent Hill 2, where the mechanics of the game are not what's fun about it, but it's, like, the really disturbing and psychological ramifications of certain imagery and certain things that happen in it. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's where I extract my quote-unquote fun, even though it's not, woohoo, fun! It's just, like... interpreting these messages and, like, seeing that, hey, Pyramid Head kind of means something here, and, like, I get what they're saying, and, like, oh my god, this guy did that.
Yeah,
it's just all of these, like, realizations that are fun in, mm-hmm. like, their own unique definition of fun. I don't know what I'm really saying there, but it's just, like, fun is different when you're talking
about part of the fun, think of Portal. Yeah. Part of the fun in Portal that everyone talks about is figuring out what it means. What is it? I mean, what does it mean in the context of its own story? Mm-hmm. Is there anything else to it? What, this cake shit keeps coming up? What's this about?
Right.
You know? I mean, so again, like, it is a response to that. It's like, I absolutely see what he means. And I think that, like, the example he's talking about is a didactic game. At the point when this hypothetical, hilariously hypothetical hopscotch game, it's not about hopscotch at all.
Right.
It's crudely about teaching you and moralizing. And that's bad. That's crap. That's not art.
Right.
That's, you know. So here's another response that was cool from Face Crank. I don't know if it was cool. I thought it was worth quoting. I'll decide after I read it again. So to try and claim that Blacksite was in some way a cultural high point or in any way a criticism of modern political notions lacks credibility. I also take issue with bogus notion that the game industry is some sort of monolithic interest with a unified sense of direction. What EA wants to accomplish with Madden is different than what 2K wants to accomplish with Bioshock, whereas the former is a means of entertainment. The latter is a means of commentary as well as being entertaining. Okay, mm-hmm. so I agree with that. The paradox that dogs gaming is in its very name. When were gamers ever supposed to be high art or culture? And how do you go any length at all to make something that must be first entertaining before it attempts to be art? Someone might say that the art that goes into a game design qualifies the medium as being art, but that hardly suffices. Every mass market movie requires volumes of costume design, set design, artistic direction, and so on. But does that make these movies the same kind of art that's, compared Toy Story to No Country for Old Men? Perfect. And here's the last one that see if you respond to. Shet says, games are for fun, rarely become art in any sense of the word. Someone who feels conflicted about the use of military force simply isn't going to play a shooter game, so it hardly matters what the content is from their perspective. Mm-hmm. In the end, it's just entertainment. But still, to be able to enjoy a war game for fun and excitement, doesn't one have to accept the premise I proposed? And I can answer that as no. I mean, I love war games. I love shooters. And I sometimes do feel conflicted about the use of military force, depending on the circumstance. That's part of the question is when is force used and how is it used? And it could be absolutely, like, I'm totally fascinated by the use of force, you know, and how it works out from tactical points of view and all these things and social and historical points of view. But that doesn't mean that you advocate the use of force in every situation, or they don't regret it on the part of, you know, for the part of our nation's history and things like this.
I do.
So you can't play a shooter?
I just think we should kick ass all the time.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, the games, yeah, that games are made right for you.
America, right or wrong, love it or leave it.
So what do you, any thoughts on this?
Me? I guess not Ryan, because Ryan's passed out about half an hour ago. Hi, Ryan.
I'm here.
Okay.
What are you talking about?
All right. Yeah, well, I mean, I think you've said it right, and these actually were amazing posts that you read here. Those were really well thought out, you know. I think that
what you
I
think,
like
son?
Purple. That's what I think. I don't know. I have nothing to add.
Yeah, I mean, well, just the original NPR thing. I mean, it's good that there's yet another media story that's about games that's not simply saying that, hey, by the way, you can rape hookers in this game.
Right. I mean, it was good in that story that they took kind of an open point of view. They didn't start on the attack. Mm-hmm. Games aren't doing this, and that's bad. I mean, they raised the very question. Should games do? Does it matter that games do it? I mean,
and some do. They even acknowledge that some do, but they're small time games sometimes, or they're like infotainment games that you're talking about.
Sure.
There's a difference there.
Well, they also brought up this whole notion of player control, which and they bring up The Sims,
right,
as an example.
Right, the Sims. Mm-hmm.
Where they're like, yeah, there's, how can you have a message in a game where it's totally up to the player to determine whether you're going to torture these people or whether you're going to have them live out normal, happy lives, or whether you're going to have them, you know, go down a dark corporate path. And, you know, and the answer is, like, some games aren't like that.
Yeah, that struck me as a cop-out because you're like, again, with most games, and this is part of the point of BioShock, is that you really have little to no control over the outcome, and you're still being told a story, and the blanks you're filling in are so specific as to be ultimately meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you shoot this guy first or this guy second? You're still shooting him.
Yeah, I mean, and this, again, to bring up the old stupid art, our Graham's art argument, that was like Roger Ebert railed on and said, like, the main reason he thinks they can't is because there is no authorial control. No, the game makers aren't ultimately in charge. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, BioShock is the counter argument to that, or other games like BioShock, where you're just like, well, here's a game that's telling you, nope, Ken Levine knows exactly what he's doing.
Right,
he's
Portal as well. I mean, I love to think of those two games together because
but I think a guy like Roger Ebert probably doesn't even understand what a game is in the modern day world.
You know,
he's thinking of
the other element.
That's he probably doesn't even know what games exist that have stories, right? To him, they're just things. Yeah. You shoot
and
it.
I didn't
you shoot at things.
Bridge up the old Roger Ebert argument again.
Well, sure.
But it is that generational thing. We can put it in the context of Susan Jacoby, whose book, you know, I just mentioned. It's like you can tell, like, if you're going to be, say you're an old, you know, crusty music critic, and you can listen to, you know, you're say you're normally used to working in the classical field, you can listen to someone's hip-hop record and it won't take you any longer than it takes anyone else to listen to it. But to play a game and understand it, like if you were to try to give, you know, like one thing I would point out to her is Company Heroes and the way that it works, and that it's like to say, because her argument is that, you know, when you read a book or something, I mean, she's really big on literacy and just, you know, bemoaning the fact that
among
all these other, these other things in American society that were, people are less and less interested in reading in the traditional sense, you know, and she differentiates this between the kind of reading we do online and how it's, you know, qualitatively different. But so she said that when you read a good book, you're fostering thought and all these other things that are beneficial outside of the context of understanding that book sequel. Mm-hmm. The point she wants to make is that the only skills you get from playing a video game, no matter how deviously challenging they might be, is a skill that's going to be useful only in, and not even just useful, it's going to be worthwhile only in the context of beating another game that's even
that's
more
ridiculous.
Challenging than the other.
That's totally ridiculous.
And it's totally offensive. This is why I was almost screaming at the book as I was reading it as I was going to bed, because, you know, when you know, the case in point for, you know, I can think of Company Heroes because I play it so much, is that when we're playing as a team, we're not only thinking about our ability to react to unpredictable, you know, changes in circumstance, our ability to work together to establish leadership, you know, the flexibility and all these things, to see through disagreement, you know, where when someone's like, let's do this tactic, you know, this is, we're going to lose, or, you know, let's do this, finding a compromise for that. When someone is ready to quit the game because they're so bummed out, like dealing with their morale and getting them to like, come on, man, we could do it. I mean, all these things, those are absolutely, you know, they're from her pragmatic, you know, criteria for evaluating the quality, the worthwhileness of a game. It totally passes the test because all those are problem-solving skills, you know, and social skills that you use on a daily basis.
Right. You could even reduce it down to a more abstract that, you know, that doing logic puzzles is just exercising your mind in that way, in the same way that doing crossword puzzles is. You know, you could probably get the same writer and have her talk about crossword puzzles, and she's not going to make that kind of claim.
Right. But I totally see that as a sort of like a generational bias. I mean, and we have that, but that's the thing, is because it's like, yeah, you can't just immediately access a video game and say, okay, I kind of get it. Even though, like, you know, that music critic, the classical music critic who first picks up a hip-hop album is just going to listen to it and be like, this proves my point exactly. I mean,
right, sure.
That's the disposition. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, at least you'll listen to it.
Right.
Instead of Google it and say video games.
Well, once again, the answer to all of this is that we just have to have all the old people die. Once they're all dead, then it's just us left, and we grew up with the games. And hopefully this argument, maybe not this generation, but the next one, this whole games aren't this and games aren't that won't be around anymore, because the only people left on the planet will be the people who actually grew up with them and have a more innate, deep understanding of what they are and what they aren't.
Right. To be fair, if everyone is doing nothing but playing games,
and
watching this other shit, then that's frightening to me as well. The reason I'm pointing out, we're trying, and, you know, an end guy, we're having this discussion, and it's like, and people are jumping in and just like repeatedly missing our point.
Uh-huh.
Then you got the thing where you may turn COD off tonight.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe we'll just be like limbless brains in jars staring at screens. You know, it won't matter.
Blah, shiny.
That what would be the point of keeping those brains around then?
I don't know.
Yeah. Let's talk about Ray Kurzweil. let's be hair splitting singularity. Well, because, you know, I mean, Ray Kurzweil, the futurist, is his whole take is that because technology improves at a quantifiably exponential rate, that means that somewhere in the predictably near future, we're going to hit this point. And we're able to make machines that can function in the same way that sorry, it's such a patronizing tone of voice for this, but that machines that function with the exact same capacity as the human mind.
Right.
And beyond that,
Cylons.
We'll be able to put our, basically, the equivalent of our conscious, the process of our brain, onto some sort of non or inorganic storage medium and continue to exist without bodies. And then the point, though, then there are those that are like, well, if this is the case and the machines become so efficient, then why would they want to bother putting the guy who whatever, who eats a vat of gravy and wipes his mouth off with his breast. Why do they want to put bother taking up hard drive space with that?
Fracking toasters.
Mm-hmm. I have to watch last week's episode still.
I was out of...
No spoilers, please.
I was out of my home last weekend, so I missed it.
Out of the home.
Too. I was away on a 3-day getaway with my wife. Yoga retreat.
Oh, boy.
No less, yeah. Did a lot of yoga.
Tantric?
No, not tantric. Sheesh. Regular all-American yoga.
Was Sting there?
Yeah. Not the whole time. Wasn't doing yoga 9 to 5. It was like a couple hours a day, and then we would just go hang out by the river, and basically I just got away from electronics. I promised an electronic-free weekend, but I somehow managed to bring my PSP anyway.
So. What did you play on it?
Well, I got a bunch of games from our game giveaway that we had here, that we have at 1UP.com. Every once in a while, we stockpile up, and then we have kind of a lottery system to pass them out amongst the
Every
editors.
Once in a while being, this is the first time we've done it.
Yeah. Every once in a while, starting now, we just did one. Well, I guess
there
EGM
so many.
EGM
well,
cool has
for
done
us
it in the past,
because it used to be that, like, well, EGM has always done this.
Right.
And here, it's like people would just, at CGW/GFW, people would just keep whatever they got, but it was like the wealth wasn't distributed equally because
right.
few people would get all the games and the rest of us wouldn't get
right.
shit.
Right, we would get like 8 copies of the latest Sims expansion.
People to be remembered.
And then like 1 copy of Company of Heroes, that kind of thing. Yeah.
What are you saying?
But, well, we're not
Sims
naming
expansion.
Names.
Yeah, so
we're not naming names of those so who
you,
hoard games. So I brought the pile of stuff that I got at the game giveaway, and I got a bunch of PSP stuff on purpose because for years it's been the dedicated $300 Lumen S machine. I felt like bitter and frustrated.
I forgot that. How much are they now? The PSP, I think I did pay that. It was like $300.
Yeah, because I got one at the beginning.
I got one just recently. It was sub 200. I can't remember if it was 149 yeah. or 199.
Maybe, am I exaggerating? Was it ever 300?
Maybe it was more than
maybe it was 250. Some, I don't know.
I'm ashamed if I paid $300.
Yeah, I know I paid a lot. God. I know I did. So I got, I picked up a bunch. I picked up Wipeout Pulse.
Nice, I got that too.
GTA Liberty Cities.
Stories.
Liberty City Stories. Right.
That's an essential PSP game.
So you say.
The you mean times. Like it has the logo that says Essential PSP Game? Or?
No, it's Essential.
Oh, you mean, this is one of Ryan's Essentials.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. He's being sinister and coy here.
Then I got a
GTA is key.
I got a tennis game, like Sega...
Superstar Tennis,
yeah, I got
Sonic
that.
Sonic and Samba de Amigo
yep.
play tennis against each
I got some other... No, it's not that. No.
Oh, okay.
No. It's more like a... Top spin kind of thing.
Virtua Tennis. Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Virtua Tennis.
Maybe. You're just making shit up.
No, I'm not making
whatever.
It up. Whatever it's called. Anyway, you get to do like a world tour playing tennis. I'm sure certain listeners know what
Virtua
I'm talking
tennis.
About.
Sounds like a tennis game.
Some other sports game. And then I picked up, just out of curiosity, I picked up Sims Castaway just to see what it was like on another platform. But
usually
all I...
they change them pretty fundamentally and make them more like goal-oriented games that aren't really
yeah.
games.
Well, that one still has a shrink wrap on it. Oh, and I got a collection of pinball.
I like got
Williams
that.
Pinball no, machines. Or
did you get? Well, there's the Gottlieb pinball collection.
Gottlieb,
for PSP.
That's what I got.
That's okay, but I also got the Williams collection for Wii, which has got much better game. We have we're from different eras, so maybe you like the really old simple boards. But I like Whirlwind and Pinbot.
No,
I'm
you're
not
right.
saying I'm not saying you do.
He's
but
right.
It's a possibility.
Right. Target.
You are not insulting me.
It
He's
could
right.
be like no, you could be like what the middle. Fuck is up with this like clickety clackety circus of plastic and rotating parts.
You are absolutely
fans.
Right. Uh-huh. Yes,
and I like that. That was
right.
Mine.
I get that. It's okay.
Yeah, it's fine.
We're from different eras. Yeah.
So the thing about the Gottlieb one, it's cool, is that you can go through. It's sort of like an arcade, a pinball museum, and they have some really old ones to the point where, good God, there's 3 bumpers up in the top, and you have 2 flippers, and the rest of the board is just like a wasteland of smooth wood.
Yep.
Wow.
And they have those, and they do have some.
I remember
they
museum.
Have some with like
right
multiple ramps and traps and things like that. Quadruple flippers.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool.
Yep. pretty fun on the PSP. The ones I ended up gravitating towards just over the weekend for no particular reason whatsoever were GTA, which I thought was pretty amusing because I was doing this whole peaceful retreat away from the city, away from nature. You know, my wife didn't even know I had the PSP. And then late at night, you know, I'm playing GTA. Felt kind of bad about that.
Undoing your day's work.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. The karmic balance shifting the other way. And then just because I couldn't help it, and it's where I'm at now after like 3 days of still being like, the PSP is going to be my machine for the next few days just for fun. I went back to Lumen S.
You did, yeah.
Yeah.
I got a bunch of PSP games from the giveaway as well, and I'm going through them one by one and finding myself, for the most part, really disappointed. I picked up Silent Hill Origins thinking that this looks cool, like really high production value. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, I played God of War was great. I think that was a fantastic PSP game. But so I started playing Silent Hill, and it was like, I don't know, I played it maybe for 2 hours, and I got to the point where... I mean, most games are the way that I'm about to describe, but this one is especially the perfect embodiment of where the design is to say, we really want to tell you a story. This is going to be the carrot that's going to lead you on, and we're always going to keep it like a foot in front of your face. But what the game is actually going to consist of is we'll create some geometry called a hospital. It's in every game, given a number of rooms, and we're going to keep you in a certain part of this building, and then we'll have a piece of a multi-part puzzle in each room. And we're going to keep you going back and forth between these rooms. Maybe now and then we'll put a dumb monster out for you to hit to death with a hammer. But then there will be like, say you need to get 7 plastic organs to stick in a plastic cadaver. And you got to go to one room to get a clue to get another. Then you go in another room and get a clue to get... a clue to get another clue to get another piece of the organ. And you go on and on. You're like, okay, I've been going back and forth between these fucking rooms for 30 minutes. The end is in sight. There's this one door I know I basically need like a pair of eyeballs to open. I'm going to get to this door and it's all going to be good. They're going to give me a little bit more story and something's going to happen. But no, you do it and it's like, here's another little wing of the hospital and you're going to do this again for another 30 minutes. But it's basically... I've just seen through it, you know? Like, I would rather just watch the 25-minute machinima that told the entire story and left out the part where I went back and forth between rooms looking for plastic organs for however many hours the game is in total. It's just a really shitty just design, I think. I mean, it's...
Well, just, you know... making the game longer for no reason, just for artificial methods.
Right? It made me also appreciate why Resident Evil 4 seemed like such a step forward for the series. And even though Resident Evil has never been as bad as Silent Hill in this respect, but it's like you're always feel as though you are moving somewhere new. You know, it'll never keep you in an area too long. It'll never like just basically tell you, we don't got that much level here, so let's go really slow and enjoy the level we're going to give you. You know, so yeah, it did make me appreciate that. And the even previous like console-based Silent Hills are much better. I think this was handled by like outsourced to a studio, and while they got the vibe and they got all the pieces of the formula right, it's got none of the magic. And it's even doubly frustrating because not only are you in the hospital, they find even more ways to get their money's worth from the geometry, because there's the dark world that you enter when you go and touch a mirror, and it's the same thing covered
with
in like
lighting
and shit and puke
dirt
on the walls like they always are.
The rust and the dirt.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like those games. I have never played any of the... I've only played the canon ones, like 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
And I love thoroughly
I really
those.
Want to see... I always talk about 4, The Room. I want to see that remade with, like... I mean, the room central was, premise of it is so fantastic. If they do something more with it and make the rest of the game good.
Yeah, The Room had, the like, what you were describing almost for me, like, the actual game of it was so much more of a more drudgery than even the other two that I'd played before, 2 and 3.
That was the bummer.
And I was like, the room itself was such an awesome idea, and then they went in such an awesome direction with it, like when they kind of take your safety space away. Mm-hmm. But like, just the shoving, my problem
I would
was,
love to
was
see
the
like,
ghosts.
Have like Monolith or someone just outright steal that idea and do it. Like, you know, because like, you know, I'm playing Condemned 2. I'm like, this is such fantastic gameplay. What if this Silent Hill played like this? Silent Hill 4, The Room played like this? Or what if this game had, you know, the setup of the other game? It would be,
Cool. Those two need to get married.
I got to play Condemned 2. I hear nothing but good things.
I started it.
Don't let your wife catch you playing it.
I didn't play
the first
one.
It's pretty hardcore, nasty.
Yeah. It's
Yeah.
I started playing the second one because I got that in the game giveaway.
Yep.
And I hadn't played the first one. Should I go back? Because I'm like, no. I'm like, what the hell is going on here?
I was the same way. I never finished the first one because it was like...
It seems like I should know something about like why this character is experiencing this thing.
Go to Wikipedia.
Or he's doing.
Yeah, just maybe just read the Ricky entry on
read
it.
The Wiki
it seems like I'm missing some key stuff, and maybe the game is intentionally leaving that out. Maybe I'm not supposed to know anything. Maybe if I played the first one, I'd still be left in the dark. Like, but I can't tell.
I missed that whole part where like you become a homeless guy at the end of the first one, apparently, because that's how you start the second.
Mm-hmm.
But I was able to just sort of, you know, go through and appreciate it. And again, maybe for that one, not so much that, like, what's up with, why are there these tar-like sacks of shit on the roof and what's coming out
right.
of them to get me is to just the basic of, like, that's some scary shit. I don't want that on me anymore.
Not knowing is kind of cool because it is evocative. Like, yeah. You can kind of make up your own fucked up little story about what's going on there.
Right. Yeah, I mean,
maybe knowing the real truth would diminish it.
Manhandling the TV antennas to get some reception on
to get that
freaky message.
Guy to talk to you.
Your wife, though, it's the kind where you'll be embarrassed. Your wife will probably directly tell you that this is disgusting and you shouldn't be playing this in your house. Because, I mean, say, even though your daughter's definitely, you know, getting old enough to deal with this kind of thing. I mean, if your wife comes in and she hears a guy go, fuck you, after you beat him in the head with the 2x4 with a nail in it, and he reels back, and then you grab him in a headlock and stick his head in an industrial press, and then slowly ratchet the handle down until his head blows up, and she sees this, and hears the guy screaming as it's happening. I don't think she's going to, like... respond.
And I could be yelling
way.
Into my daughter's room. How's your essay on nonviolence coming, honey? Die, motherfucker!
They scream that. I mean, that's part of the impact of it. Is like the guys. I mean, just like not only is it just get the kinetic,
it's relentless
vibe of it all.
Now, any game that even just looks like that thing looks on the box is something I just know. I'm only playing it on Saturday, like when they're shopping.
Yeah.
As soon as they're out of the house, I'm like, woohoo, where's the most violent thing in the house?
Or she even walked up. You know, you come across the corpse that's been like basically like vivisected in their room, and you've got to take all these forensic photos and send them back to HQ.
I haven't done
so
that
you're
yet.
Taking all these, sorry for the spoiler, you're taking all these close-ups of just this vivisected body, and then you got to pick it up afterward and drag it outside to take it back to the lab after.
Yeah, okay. Not playing this one there.
Yeah, so if you, that's another
Hey guys,
thing.
Watch me play this one.
Well, I always love those kind of games, like, alone in the dark anyway.
Yeah.
Like, just no one's around, turn off the lights, let that be your evening.
Mm-hmm.
It can really fuck you up. If it's the right kind of game.
Mm-hmm. Doom did that to me back in the day.
Yeah, this is a whole other story.
Yeah.
It's one thing to shoot the demon, and the other thing is for the stuff.
Well, yeah.
That goes on with these guys.
Yeah. So I think our angrier listeners this week may make a note of the fact that we didn't really talk about PC games.
Yeah.
We talked about games.
Well, we talked
in
about
general.
Computer Gaming World's old history. Anyway, this is the new GFW radio. We can do whatever the fuck we want.
I think we talked about themes that resonate
as opposed
with
to the
PC
old
games.
Old
where we had a rigid. What am I saying? Yeah, what did that even mean just now?
Just babbling, man.
Yeah, I'm
just
babbling. Specific set schedule.
Yeah.
2006, that's going to be the new code. Every time you do one of these things, straight at us.
What was odd there was it came out of my mouth with like total confidence. Like I knew it was 2006.
Yeah, it was like...
Hey, maybe it was for a second.
Maybe it was for me. Maybe that's what happens.
You boiled some water and it took the pan and stuck it in the cupboard, you know, with the boiling water in it when you're done. And then you went and you put your, I don't know, you're going to take your contacts out and you squirted your handful of soap or hair gel or something.
I know what he's talking about.
You don't know what's going on.
No, I don't.
I know what's going on.
I'm basing these on some of the things that neurologist Oliver Sacks has cited among people with severe sort of either like post encephalitis and other other
it's
traumatic.
Is that what you're saying about me?
Brain injuries.
Shit.
Well,
I do that anyway, though.
Ryan, even for you this week, you've been particularly quiet. Is there something going on?
I'm low energy this week. I'm really tired.
Are you?
He's had one of those sour tongue tinglers stuck in his teeth the whole time, just trying to extract it.
Yeah, why are you particularly tired this week? Anything you want to share with us?
I haven't slept Well, the last couple nights. I was up writing some previews for 1UP last night.
Were you?
Yes, I was.
What'd you write?
Oh, for that 3 a.m. embargo?
Yep.
3 a.m. embargo?
For what? Yeah, isn't that weird?
Yeah.
That is some amazing...
Because people are going to be up reading the news.
Europe is
that is some amazing procrastination.
Is it a, is it a game that they have like a huge European audience?
Maybe so, huh?
Oh, it was a Nintendo event, and they were...
Probably
oh,
there you go. Wide embargo, yep.
All their like WiiWare stuff.
I see.
So...
So you were up till 3 working on that?
Well, I was stupidly up till 3. Just, I don't know why I was up till 3, because I just do that sometimes.
Is that why you were late for work today?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's in your file.
That's in the file.
Yeah, I made a check mark.
WiiWare.
Tardy. Ryan's got tardy.
Got nothing to say about WiiWare?
I'm tired too, but a dog's been keeping me.
There's a...
Oh, and thank you to the listeners who... sent in well wishes for my dog. Thank you.
Very appreciate nice it.
Yeah. Yeah, and all the PMs for the just magazine in general. Yeah.
Right. We've been getting lots of nice letters and messages still from everybody. And also further thanks to those who have been contributing to the thread and messages to me about the direction they want to see things go on 1UP.com on the PC side. We're definitely looking at everything you guys are reading and taking it seriously. So we have lots of good ideas. There's lots of stuff we're going to be working on. So,
you know what we forgot?
What?
Do it at the end. We'll just have to send people out on it. We were going to bring back Heroes of the Web in a different form.
Yeah.
Might call the segment in their own voices, at least this version of it. And so what you're about to hear is an opera... A piece of an opera composed by fans of the game Final Fantasy VII. What you're about to hear is not intended to be funny. You're not supposed to laugh at it. It was made in all seriousness. What they did was they take the orchestral score from Final Fantasy VII, wrote lyrics to it, wrote songs, you know, and then performed these and did every song in the game and put it out. So this is a snippet of Ode to Green.
Green as a child's heart, unknowing of men's evils.
Nearby. It's him.